Welcome back, pod people, to a new episode of Cinema D'Amore. I'm one of your hosts, Justin Morgan. I'm here with
Joe Phillips.
He's another host. And we are starting 2022. It's actually season one, episode 231. Will we have a season two? I'm not quite sure. Maybe we just do episodes infinitely.
It's a never-ending season.
Till the season finale,
yeah.
Which would also be the series finale, if we ever stop.
Yeah.
We're continuing last week's discussion, technically. We are going into directors, and we decided to double it up this month and do the Coen brothers. So we're carrying over from the Hudsucker Proxy this episode and the next three. So these four episodes coming up for this month, they're all going to be the Coen brothers, and they will all be in chronological order. Obviously, we're doing four and not their entire filmography, but I'm sure we'll be talking about things from their entire filmography throughout.
Just to start off, to get into this film, I have never seen this movie before. It's one that I've like owned for a while, but I just never got around to it. I don't know. I just never really watched like a bunch of their early stuff. This is the first time I watched Blood Simple. Rewatched Raising Arizona because I've seen that multiple times, and that's always a fun one. And then I'd never seen Miller's Crossing either.
Yeah, those are the first couple.
I already knew I liked Raising Arizona because, like I said, I've seen that one before. That's always a funny one. But I thought Blood Simple was really good for like a first film. I enjoyed the two villains that they have in there, especially like M. Emmett Walsh is really good as the weird, creepy private detective who just makes terrible racist and sexist jokes the entire time. I thought that was a really good movie. It was a really entertaining one. And then Miller's Crossing was also great. And that was their first time working with John Turturro. And I thought he was fantastic in that movie. It was a good chance to get into some of those other ones that I'd say the ones I've watched the most are probably from Fargo through True Grit. That section's the ones that I've seen the most. And then I've watched only like once all of their newer stuff. And I had never really watched a lot of those early movies. Watching them in order from the very first one, and then even including Hudsucker Proxy, which is what they did after Barton Fink, they really do love to like not have a genre to work in, or they love to put 10 different genres into one film, which this one does too. Barton Fink adds a lot of different things all into one thing.
Barton Fink is their fourth film, so it's Blood Simple, Raising Arizona, Miller's Crossing, then Barton Fink. Hudsucker's number five. Blood Simple is what put them on the map, and it does have that really like great debut film. It kind of has the slapstick element to it too.
Yeah, there's some of it in there.
That one character that won't die, you know.
What I thought when I was watching that was that made me think of A Simple Plan. We talked about it on Hudsucker Proxy, and we talked about it on our Simple Plan episode about how Raimi and the Coen brothers are connected and they've worked with each other multiple times. Sam Raimi even cameos in Miller's Crossing as one of the detectives. That 100% made me think of part where Bill Paxton has to kill the guy that he assumes somebody else already killed, and now it's a burden of having murdered that guy is on him. But they play it obviously a lot differently in something like Blood Simple, where he assumes that Frances McDormand killed him because that's her ex-husband, or still is her husband, but she left him. So the M. Emmett Walsh makes it all seem like she's the murderer because he's trying to pin it on her is like the jealous ex or something that killed her husband because he was an asshole or something. So he assumes that that's who killed him. And then when he has to actually kill the husband, that like makes him have like a psychotic break. He had to murder somebody and he's not that type of person. Again, a lot of connections to some stuff we've already covered and watched. But yeah, I thought that was fantastic. And then Miller's Crossing was a really fun take on gangster films. It didn't specifically feel like a gangster film necessarily, even though it kind of gets into that genre. It's still filled with a lot of just ridiculous humor and has those random comic elements. Again, John Turturro's great in it. Steve Buscemi pops up in that one.
And the moment where they're taking out the guy to shoot and kill him is really tense and kind of hard to watch almost. It's such a powerful moment.
Gabriel Byrne's a great character in that because he doesn't play your typical gangster that you're thinking of from like old film noirs and stuff, that he's the tough guy that always has like the upper hand. He spends most of that movie getting punched in the face, knocked over, thrown around. His character the entire time feels like he's always secure and like knows that he's going to come out on top, even when he's like constantly getting knocked down the stairs, thrown out of the way, has a gun in his face. But he always like has that calm demeanor that he's definitely going to be the one that comes out on top no matter what. And Albert Finney's great in that movie. All the performances were really good in that. I really enjoyed that film. Yeah, I'm kind of mad that I didn't watch these sooner. I've owned most of them for years on DVD or something, and I don't know, just never got around to watching them.
I have that first four film set that was on DVD, and then I upgraded it to Blu-ray. And I got the Blood Simple Criterion. There's a Miller's Crossing Criterion. So half that set I'm going to basically rebuy for Criterion.
When are we getting the Raising Arizona Criterion? That's what we need.
We will probably get it. I wouldn't be surprised.
I wouldn't be surprised if a Barton Fink Criterion would come too.
Well, Barton Fink just came out on Kino Lorber, so I don't think that...
Yeah.
I really was thinking that it was going to be a Criterion release, but I don't think it will be for quite some time, actually, or if ever. They'll probably never give it up. I doubt it. The one that I don't own and I haven't watched in a long time, probably like 15 years, is The Man Who Wasn't There, the noir Billy Bob Thornton film. And I saw it was $12 online for the Blu-ray. When I looked it up on Blu-ray.com, there was a Criterion listed for it. They never made any sort of announcement, so I thought I'll just hold off and see.
Yeah, that's one of the only other ones that I haven't watched. We're only covering four films, but I'm still probably just going to continue watching their other films.
Because you brought up Intolerable Cruelty, which is, I agree, their worst. And it's only the worst because it doesn't feel like Coen's. It's so plain and it's not...
I looked it up too because I had to like double check some stuff. That was one that I read the background details on that they weren't supposed to direct. It was one that they wrote a script for. It got passed around from a bunch of different directors. And I think they only ended up directing it more or less probably as a favor to somebody or to like fulfill some sort of studio contract, because that maybe is why it seems like they didn't, I don't know, maybe just didn't care as much. Like they thought it was just going to be a writing gig and were like, we'll just write a script and somebody else can make this movie.
I think I own it, maybe.
Felt like a Peter Jackson on the first Hobbit.
Yeah, possibly. I'll have to rewatch it and see. I don't know if I have it, but the Lady Killers remake is another one of theirs, and I've always liked their Lady Killers.
I enjoy the Lady Killers. I like that
one.
People
make fun of it, but like I thought it's hilarious.
It feels like they did really embrace just, I don't know, doing stupid stuff, or not doing stupid stuff, but just kind of letting all those actors just kind of embrace their strange characters. J.K. Simmons, Tom Hanks is great in it. I really like the Lady Killers. I haven't watched that one in a while, and again, I might try to get that one in at some point in between all these.
The original is, I don't know if it's considered a comedy, but when I watched them back to back, this was years ago too. I haven't watched Lady Killers in a long time. The Coens is a hell of a lot more funny. It feels like it's a parody of some sort more so than anything else. I do want to say, though, you brought it up with Hudsucker Proxy. The Coen brothers have directed every single film together except for the brand new The Tragedy of Macbeth. Due to the DGA guidelines, though, like you said, there can only be one director on a picture.
Yeah.
Even these first couple movies that all have Joel Coen as the director, they were actually directed by both of them. I did see The Tragedy of Macbeth. Yeah. And I thought it was fucking great. Not very humorous. So maybe our theory about Ethan being the funny guy is...
I saw he has, and I mean, this isn't always like 100% accurate, but on IMDb, he does have some project listed, Ethan Coen. I'm not even going to bother looking it up right now. I'll try to find it later, maybe for next episode. But it sounded like a goofy like spy movie, and it had a weird title that sounded like a comedy. And I'm like, yeah, maybe it is true. Ethan's going to start doing comedies while Joel just keeps doing like tragedies.
His initial quote, I looked it up because I only heard what you said on the last episode, and basically he said way before Tragedy of Macbeth came out, and Ethan Coen basically said he doesn't know if he'll return to filmmaking because he wants to focus back on being a playwright, and that is how he started.
Yeah.
He started writing plays, and that's probably a huge influence for the Barton Fink character, but it just makes 100% sense. Like, it doesn't sound like he hates cinema. It just feels like he misses being in the theater, and he wants to return to that. We're not going to discuss it on this podcast. I guess we easily could, because on Apple Plus, I believe they get Tragedy of Macbeth January 14th or something like that, mid-January.
Yeah, I think it's pretty
soon. So it's not like we couldn't cover it and fit it in if we really wanted to get a bonus or something. But I like that we can maybe let some of these things like soak in a little bit. But I have to say, I'm actually honest. I'm surprised that The Tragedy of Macbeth, which is essentially a play, is something that Ethan Coen wasn't interested in. Maybe he wanted to do one of Shakespeare's comedies. He didn't want to do one of the tragedies.
Yeah.
He follows it up with The Comedy of Macbeth, and he retells the story, but it's fucking hilarious or something.
It's hilarious, yeah.
I don't know if you can make it hilarious.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't really spoil Macbeth. It's the fucking same story it's pretty much always been. But I really liked the black and white photography. I liked that it was like real minimal sets. Everything looked like it was on a stage with fog machine almost. I'm kind of gunning for it to win cinematography. And I thought it was one of Denzel Washington's best movies ever. So I would be interested to see him be up for Academy Award and win.
That would be nice.
Yeah. Hopefully I didn't get the Omicron virus. I watched The Tragedy of Macbeth in theaters on Monday, and I watched Licorice Pizza in theaters on Tuesday. I would have watched them back to back, but they're only playing in one theater. Both Chuck, you will absolutely positively love Licorice Pizza.
I know, I do. I'm definitely going to see it. You still have your AMC, and I haven't gotten around to either going with that or just getting out to seeing as many movies. At the end of last year, the only three things I saw in theaters were Fast 9, Bond, and Spider-Man. Those are only three movies I saw in theaters. Would have saw West Side Story, but we got that food poisoning from Friday. So
I did go back to see West Side Story. I didn't get to see it at the Dolby Theater because at that time, Spider-Man had already come out. Our friends at the Three Deemers podcast, they're doing musicals this month, and you should give their West Side Story episode a listen. They needed a last-minute guest, and I said, well, I only saw the first one because I got food poisoning and never went to see the new one. I really enjoyed it. It might be one of my top 10 movies, too. I really want to get Chuck's opinion on the movie because when they speak Spanish in the movie, they don't subtitle it.
Yeah, I heard that.
So I'm interested to see if your year of Spanish has paid off.
Yeah, what I can pick up.
Yeah, I think maybe I saw double the movies that you ended up seeing because I saw Halloween Kills last night in Soho. I didn't see Fast 9 theaters. You really risked your life for the Fast and Furious franchise.
Because it's about family.
Yeah, I don't know. It's hard to say because I was thinking, I want to see Tragedy of Macbeth and I want to see it while this is going on. I didn't realize that it was coming to Apple TV in January. I knew it was an Apple TV film, but for some reason, I just didn't think it was going to drop that soon, which is actually really appropriate probably for people that are going to be voting for the Academy Award films. Make it easy to access for people. I mean, they'll all get screeners of it. They probably already have screeners of it.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, we're in the middle of Omicron virus right now. This is supposed to be like peak week for it. I did go to my movies matinee, and there are literally like nobody in each theater. Specifically, though, I did think this was weird, Chuck. When I went to go see The Tragedy of Macbeth in the AMC Waterfront in Pittsburgh, it was in one of the like the bigger theaters. I'm a part of the A-list member thing, so I get 12 free movies a month. And there was a section blocked off. They blocked off the reserved seating. Remember how they have like nice leather seating in the back? They had blocked that off, and I was like, how cheap are you to block that off from the A-list people? Because you still get the nicer seats when you do the Dolby Theater, and it just seemed like a weird, cheap move. Like, you really wanted to be super cheap about it, why not say, hey, we're gonna charge you a couple bucks more or something? I don't know. So they took that away from us. That's why I'm dropping it by name on the podcast. AMC controls everything. Every theater in the area has become an AMC theater, essentially. If AMC goes under, literally every theater around me is pretty much going, except one in Bridgeville and then the Luxury Cinema. That's where cheap seats used to be. Hopefully they stick around. But yeah, it sucks because, we saw Nightmare Alley. We did go to theaters to see that for Steph's birthday month. Nightmare Alley, Last Night in Soho, Tragedy of Macbeth. I think French Dispatch was one of them. They only played in that Waterfront Theater. They never played anywhere else. The Galleria by me ended up having Venom 2 playing for 3 months straight. It's probably still playing there.
It'll never stop.
Spider-Man No Way Home leaves theaters, and Venom 2 is just indefinitely there. I kind of dig the return to theaters. I just wish that theaters had more of an appeal, and they don't really, like, they're not really trying hard, because I went back to the theaters, I'm watching 25 minutes of trailers. Why the fuck are you torturing me with 25 minutes of trailers? Endless trailers and commercials.
10, 15 years ago, when they weren't posting trailers on YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, go to the theater and yeah, you'd see like three new trailers that you'd be like, oh, that's a new movie I've never heard of before. But now you see the trailer and you're like, oh my God, Jesus Christ, I've seen this 50 times on Facebook already. I don't need to see this again. Like,
or like, I really love the Dolby Cinema here, but I have to watch the same ad that they started showing in 2018. It hasn't changed. It's exactly the same. And then the trailers all play and you're like, oh, the movie's about to start. And then Nicole Kidman comes out and tells you how much she loves the theatrical experience. Please just start the goddamn movie. Even like a long movie, take Spider-Man No Way Home. That's a fucking long movie. And you're going to still play like 30 minutes of trailers beforehand. It's crazy. And you know, if you showed up 20 minutes late, the movie would already be started for some reason.
Yeah.
I'm going to be late on purpose, so I don't have to watch your trailers. That and then the people bother me. We saw Dune. I saw Dune in theaters. My sister was sitting next to some guy coughing the entire time without his mask on. Why did you even leave? Why did you even go out if you're sick like that? We were negative for COVID the following week. We didn't get it from that guy. Maybe he didn't have it, but it's sort of like, you're disgusting. What is your responsibility? Then that one especially, you didn't have to go to theaters to see it.
That's how it was when I saw Spider-Man. I loved that movie. I thought that movie was great, but probably the worst experience I've had in a theater, not even including pandemic, just everyone was getting up constantly. There was someone walking up and down out of the theater to like go use the restroom every 5 minutes. I don't know if they just showed up late on purpose or they were standing in line because the lines for popcorn and drinks were ridiculously long. But it's like the movie is started and there's like people walking in, like turning on their phone light so they can see the numbers for the seats. And like somebody like flashed their phone in my face and was like, these are our seats. And I'm like, no, they're not. Like, and I didn't even pull my tickets out because I was just like, they're not. And I just kept looking at the screen and waited till like I think they got the usher and he like,
was the movie already on?
Oh, the movie's like started. Like the movie is on and I'm like trying to watch the first 10 minutes of it. And like people are just still walking in, not sure where they're going. People like, I don't know, can't read numbers on the floor that say like 24, 25. I don't know, like basic stuff you should know from kindergarten, how to count and how to read. They're like, I don't know where I sit. And I'm like, there's letters and numbers on the floor. Like, what do you mean you don't know where you sit? What does your ticket say? Does it say H25? Then sit in H25. I'm in H24, so get away from me.
Actually, that sounds more like, get right next to me.
Yeah, that was one of the worst times I've had in a theater.
These theaters want people to come back because they're bombing from the pandemic. The least you could do is provide an actual experience. It's always people. People are the only thing that will make the theatrical experience terrible. And I mean, I had a similar thing, and it fits when I went to go see Hail Caesar because it's Coen Brothers. Me and Chris went to go see it. We're sitting there. The movie starts. Like when it actually starts, this guy walks in and he stops in front of us and just starts watching the movie directly in front of us. So I tap him on the shoulder. I'm like, excuse me, we're trying to watch the movie. And he's like, I'm sorry. And then he walked out of the way and he said something like loud, like, I was just there for a fucking second. Big fat guy stood in front of us and the movie's actually on. Go find your seat. Wasn't dark, you know? I'm for a better theatrical experience. If you're watching it with people that are engaged in the movie, you usually will have a wonderful experience. I think when I went to go see Spider-Man 2, I had a kid next to me, and when the trailer for The Batman played, he was like, he sparkles instead of broods really loudly, and nobody reacted to it. Please don't be doing this throughout all of Spider-Man. I beg of you. He didn't. Because he didn't get a reaction. You give them a reaction, and then they continue.
That first reaction. If he'd got that first one,
he would have done it for everything. But I don't know how many movies that we'll end up covering that are brand new. Maybe we'll just stick to the directors for a while.
I don't know who decided to design this DVD, the menu system for it, but it like spoils the end of the film. Basically, when you turn it on, and you know, I guess we'll just say, you know, obviously we're talking about spoilers for a movie that's 30 years old at this point. We're not going to talk about the ending first, but the menu for the DVD is a flaming hallway. And then when you hit play, it's John Goodman running down the hallway with a shotgun saying his line. And after I watch the movie, it's like, that's like the end of the movie. Like you played next to last scene of the film. Why would you do that? Like,
That's like we were watching all the Scream movies getting ready for 5. And we put in like Scream 1 and it had an ad for Scream 4. I'm like, who does that? I get that it's the new movie that you want to advertise, but maybe don't throw it right in front of the movie that they're about to see. I think Lost did that too. You'd have like season 1 and it was showing you ads for season 3.
It's showing like season 3.
Why are you doing this?
I remember those. I remember the... Yeah.
It's Lost. You might like the other seasons of Lost. I mean, if you're watching Scream, you could be like, hey, there's a couple more Screams if you want to watch them.
Yeah, that feels like, give me a second to watch this film and decide for myself if I want to watch Scream 4. Like, let me watch this first.
Stay tuned for the trailer of Scream 2, maybe after Scream 1.
Yeah,
that would make more sense.
That was like the weirdest thing. And even not seeing the film, you could almost tell that that's supposed to be the end of the movie, because, you know, I don't know many films that would start with John Goodman running down the hall with a shotgun with flames shooting up around him. That doesn't sound like how a movie usually starts. So
that scene was ruined for me in film school too, because I had not seen Barton Fink, and the scene that we studied was the finale of the movie, essentially that scene that ended up in the, you know, your menu. So when I watched the whole movie, you knew that was going to happen to some degree.
Yeah.
It kind of messes with you too, because when you're in the hotel with John Turturro's character and the wallpaper and stuff's falling off and it has that glue, you're like, is that flammable glue? I don't know what it is, but our friend Chris, a couple years ago, bought me the Coen Brothers coffee table book, which I still really didn't read except for the Barton Fink, because we're doing Barton Fink. And it has some warnings, and I think it's funny because they've split it up by percentage. Warning, this film contains 20% Clifton Odet jokes. Clifton Odet wrote a play called The Big Knife, which is inspiration for this. It's the same kind of story of a playwright. Well, sorry, it's not the playwright. It's the star who was really big in these plays in New York and then went out to shitty Hollywood, and how it basically got tackled by the cheapness, and it didn't matter what his status was in New York. 18% William Faulkner jokes, 15% Louis B. Mayer jokes, 12% peeling wallpaper, 10% anti-Semitic paranoia, 7% clogged drains, 6% common men, 5% existential dread, 4% Kubrickian hallways, and 3% Nazi salutes. That's the warning. Which, I don't know, maybe that would make you want to watch the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely would suck.
Well, I mean, it's got the great cast of John Turturro and John Goodman, and very, 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 very little Steve Buscemi. But he is fucking fantastic in every moment that he is in it.
I mean, he's great in everything.
Chet the bellhop clerk.
Yeah. Yeah, he's good in this one. I didn't know if you had watched anything on New Year's Eve, like any of the particular shows or events where they have the countdowns, but the one on NBC, I think, was the one that had Pete Davidson and Miley Cyrus. Pete Davidson does a whole song with the guys from SNL, those three guys, the Please Destroy or whatever, about all his resolutions, and like they make fun of him for like they're all unrealistic. And one of his resolutions is finish that thing with Steve Buscemi, and then like Miley Cyrus keeps stopping him and going, no, what's the thing with Steve Buscemi? And he's like, I don't want to talk about it. And they keep doing the song, and he brings it up again.
Okay, I'm sorry, I'm stuck on this. What happened with you and Steve Buscemi?
I already told you, Miley, I don't want to talk about it. Oh my God, it's him.
Hey Pete, I know you're all joyful and reflective because of the new year or whatever, but I just want to say I'm not going anywhere, bitch.
Steve, you dirty dog!
Yeah, you come back to New York, it's on sight, brother. You never paid me for the King of Staten Island, mother.
Pete, you still haven't paid Steve Buscemi?
He's in Barton Fink. Dude's set for life.
That's all right. A very awesome
New Year's resolution.
That was such a super specific reference, but it made me laugh because I knew we were doing that film, and I just thought that one moment just made me laugh. Why does he need the money? He was in Barton Fink.
This movie, though, I think it weirdly balances the comedy with the tense or that psychological thriller aspect, because it kind of has like a lot of unnerving stuff, and then it has a lot of like really funny stuff. Like, I like the joke where the agent's like,
you two have some sex thing.
Sex? He's a man. We wrestled.
You're a sick fuck, Fink.
It was just like, yeah, sure.
This is probably the closest that I would describe any of their films as being almost straight up a horror film, or at least there's a lot of parts of it that are very, very much a horror film compared to a lot of their other stuff. Even their stuff that gets dark and very grim. This is the one, like the hotel in general is just very off-putting from the very start. Like as soon as he gets there, it's just this real decrepit place. We don't see anybody else in the hotel other than Barton, Chet, Pete, the elevator guy, and John Goodman is Charlie Meadows. The agents come in at the end. They come in, but we never actually see anybody else. You hear the people on the other side of his room, and you hear the people above him stomping around.
And you see
around
all the shoes left out for a shoe shining surface.
Yeah, you see the shoes left that Chet collects all the time. So it's made to seem like, oh yeah, there's definitely like hundreds of people that are staying here.
The lobby is always empty, like not just the hallway, but when he's in the main lobby, no one's there.
No one's ever there. I do enjoy the stationery that's in his room that really gives you the feeling of this hotel not being a good place. That has the tagline of just a day or a lifetime. Those are your two options. You can stay for a day or you can stay
just
forever.
Everything about that is nerve-wracking, and I feel Barton Fink is surprisingly okay with it. He's wants the right for the common man, so he's like, this is what the common man's experiencing.
Yeah. Every time he shows up at the office with the mosquito bites on his face, and everyone keeps going, oh, what's with your face? What's going on there? What's with your face? And he's just like, there's just a mosquito. And he's like, aren't you in a good hotel? We should have you in the best hotel.
It's great though when he puts his stuff on the bed and it totally caves in, sinks in, and then besides the wallpaper falling off, he moves the pencil that doesn't even have a tip on it. It's been there for so long that everything's covered in dust and there's like a clean spot. The comedy, though, is wonderful in this, where the first introduction to John Goodman, his neighbor, is that he hears wailing, crying through the wall. He calls Chet.
He's everything.
To complain about the noise next door. Within like 1 second, you can hear Chet talking to John Goodman, and then you hear him walking around out of his room and like to the front door.
I love the tracking shot of like tracking from where John Goodman would be sitting in his room all the way to his door. His door opens. He's in the hallway. He's at the front door. Well, I guess in general, the sound design. Design of this movie is amazing. We skipped over like the moment when he first arrives at the hotel and he rings that bell. It just keeps going with that note that just won't stop, and it just keeps going until Chet finally puts his finger on the bell to make it stop. The whoosh of air every time they open the doors in the hallway, you hear that so many times in that film. Just the everything's supposed to be paper thin walls.
Meadows, he basically becomes like a Kramer like character where he just like lets himself into Barton Fink's room without knocking. It gets to a point where he just lets himself in entirely.
In this scenario, I feel like I'm very much John Goodman's character. Oh boy, do I have stories for you. And then you're like, and I bet you do. Now let me tell you something. Those moments were great.
Exactly, Charlie. You understand what I'm saying a lot more than some of these literary types, because you're a real man.
And I could tell you some stories.
Sure you could. And yet many writers do everything in their power to insulate themselves from the common man, from where they live, from where they trade, from where they fight and love and converse and...
He really doesn't listen to anyone. He kind of has that narcissism where he thinks that he's like the best thing that there ever was, or he has these weird rules in his head that he has to abide by. It has that too good to be true feeling in the very beginning of the movie. So I do like where the character arc goes in this, where it's like he starts the top and essentially like ends up on the bottom. But when he's talking to the producer and they're like, oh, we're all for the writers. We do everything for the writers. And they want to assign him a movie. And so they assign him a movie about wrestling. And it's really funny. That guy doesn't know anything about wrestling. Unlike when he shows him the dailies of that other wrestling movie. It's a single shot, take after take after take after take.
Double on the canvas, 12 apple, take one.
Action! I want a sign!
God, 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 God!
Devil on a canvas, 12 apple, take two.
Action! I want a sign! I want a sign! I want a sign! I want a sign!
It's really funny. Like, what could you possibly learn about wrestling from that line that you have to hear repeatedly?
There's a lot going on. I do like that kind of like parody of Hollywood that you get there, which Barton Fink doesn't even want to go because he thinks that he's doing a higher purpose by writing his plays in New York City on Broadway. But it's more his agent convinces him to go out there because he says he can negotiate them to pay him $2,000 a week, and that'll pay for him to come back and write as many plays as he wants that might not pay that well.
It's such a strong incentive.
But he can go and write stupid movies out in Hollywood for a little while and make some money. That's how he gets enticed to go out there, is just to make some cash. He doesn't really, he doesn't seem like he cares that much. Every time someone asks him like, oh, you like the movies? And he's like, not particularly. I don't really watch the pictures, as he keeps saying.
Well, think about this, Chuck. Would you take up a kind of a questionable, shitty job if you knew that you're going to get paid lots?
Yeah.
And then maybe like the following year, we could focus on just the podcast or something that you enjoy doing.
Yeah, it'd be great.
Absolutely. You take that up in a second. And then where's the nightmare aspect come in? Because it's strange that this has that. It starts off so funny and it slowly gets less funny as the movie goes along.
Yeah, everything starts to get a lot more real and a lot more terrifying. John Goodman also, another thing that he made me think of, he's almost a more sinister version of Dell from Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
Yeah.
He's trying to be really friendly and nice, but everything about him is just vaguely off. Even from the first time you meet him, like you said, he's crying in his room. And then when he shows up at Barton Fink's door and he tries to like play it off, he wasn't the one that called. And he's like, did you call and tell him that I was being loud? And he's like, no. Well, I mean, I just thought you were in trouble, or I thought you were having problems.
Yeah, lied his face.
And there's that good shot of John Goodman where just a single tear rolls down his face. So that definitely does seem like 100% what he was doing. Like he was 100% just sitting in his room crying, which is very just creepy and off-putting. But let me come in here and give you a drink. We'll have I'll talk to you. You'll be fine. We don't need to complain anymore or anything like that. all the characters that he does meet, there is something wrong with all of them in some way. That writer that he first meets in the bathroom throwing up.
Like his idol.
Yeah, once he learns who that guy is and, can I meet you at your office? And the guy's like, yeah, show up around 3 or something like that. And when he shows up, his girlfriend opens the door and it's just him screaming in the background while he's drunk and just having like this insane tirade. And John Turturro's just like, maybe I should just come back another time. Like trying to keep this as normal as possible.
Yeah, it's satire, really. Because everything that happens in Hollywood is a pretty accurate depiction of things that would happen in Hollywood, 1,000%. He wants to get some screenwriting tips because that's what Tony Shalhoub's character suggested that he do. And the guy is always drunk, and it gets phrased by his secretary / girlfriend that he either has ideas and he's writing or he doesn't and he's drunk, which is wonderful foreshadowing because he's always drunk. Then it comes out later in the movie that she's the one that has been writing everything for him. So that is actually the person that he's been idolized. But I do like that hint of he's not being yelled at all by, you know, not being able to produce anything. He seems to be pretty well off, you know, in the nice restaurants and stuff like that. Barton Fink, great character in the sense that he's kind of that perfectionist where he wants to turn out the best work that he possibly can do. And because he's not inspired by the wrestling, he hasn't written anything. He has writer's block, essentially. Tony Shalhoub's character is like, I told him I read the script and it was great. What do you mean that you didn't write anything?
It's a great moment. Yeah, he says he sets up that meeting and he reveals that he doesn't have anything and he goes, well, you want me to have a script ready by tomorrow? And he just goes, he can't read. You just got to tell him the plot. I love what he just throws that out. Yeah, he doesn't read.
You know who this guy is, too, that plays that producer.
The thing that I'm thinking of the most is from Elf.
He is an elf, but he plays the Roger Ebert character in the Godzilla 98 movie.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that.
I couldn't quite place who he was or what I knew him from. I also have not watched Barton Fink in a very long time. It was one of the movies that I didn't own. It came out on Kino Lorber, and I bought that, but I think that was a year ago, which is essentially the reason why we're covering it, because when we got to pick our movies, I said, I haven't seen Barton Fink in forever, so Barton Fink's my choice. Barton Fink's the one that I've wanted to revisit the most. Maybe we'll go back and we'll revisit the Coen brothers at some other moment.
Yeah, we're definitely not even touching on every single aspect of their films.
They're all good ones that we're doing.
Yeah.
Intolerable Cruelty and The Lady Killers are our favorites.
I like the guy that's his assistant to the producer.
Yeah.
Who he says used to run the studio. He's like, yeah, he used to run the studio. He's like, I guess we keep him around just as like a favor to him at this point, which is funny because he's in Miller's Crossing as one of the mob bosses. It's a complete opposite role for him. He goes from that film where he's just screaming at the top of his lungs the entire time to this movie where he's like just real quietly, like sits there and nods his head every time the producer says something. He's just like he just nods his head and goes, yeah, yeah, that's what he says.
Every time he sits down, you want a coffee? Yes. He's like, Luke, go get him a coffee. Go get him that rye whiskey that he wants.
Yeah.
But I do like when he comes back with the whiskey when they're by the pool and he says to Barton, he's like, you need to show the work. And then the producer starts shouting all this anti-Semitic shit. For a moment, you think it's at Barton Fink for not doing what he was supposed to be doing. Yeah. Then he directs it towards Lou and he's like, you're fired unless you kiss Barton's shoes. It's strange. He fires him and then he ends up kissing the bottom of Barton Fink shoes. There's some bold acting there. Hopefully those were shoes that never touched the ground in real life.
Yeah.
He's a method act. No, I kissed the bottom of John Turturro's real shoes.
Yeah, his real shoes.
That's what I did. John Turturro is such a great actor in everything. This one's great because he comes off as narcissistic, but he also comes off a little pathetic and he comes off a little bit like an underdog. At least he's a fish out of water type situation, I would say, for most of this movie.
The Coen brothers do, I think, enjoy, I don't know how they might say it or how you'd want to phrase it, but just taking an actor and then just having his character be completely different. They reuse the same actors frequently. They work with the same cast a lot. They do seem like they get very comfortable when they work with somebody a lot, that they'll keep inviting them back. So someone like John Turturro, again, goes from something in Miller's Crossing where he can go back and forth from this real sad and pathetic guy who's like begging for his life, to then as soon as he thinks he's got one up on you, he immediately turns into this, I'll blackmail you and like you'll have to do everything that I say and you'll have to be my friend and help me out, like you can't say no to me, can you? And then Gabriel Byrne gets the upper hand and completely flips it on him, to then take him and put him in this film and have him play like this more weak-willed character that doesn't seem like he could really push anyone around, just always seems like he's just waiting and just getting yelled at a lot in general.
It's a great exploration of a character who has a huge ego. He has a hard lesson that he essentially learns, where it doesn't matter Maybe it's the filmmakers saying, you could have made something what people consider valuable, but then every new project is essentially starting at the bottom again. There's how many directors that have told that story where I've made an Academy Award winning films and I still can't get the money to make new movies. Nobody will produce it. I saw something the other day where somebody was saying they wanted to do a Kickstarter for James Gunn so he could make more movies or something like that. And his response was, I'm at the point where I can make any movie that I want. I mean, they're letting you do Peacemaker and they're letting you do the superhero stuff. But I bet you if you picked something obscure enough, somebody would say no.
Yeah.
I want to do War and Peace very seriously. They're going to be like, no. I guarantee.
Yeah, that's how it was for a long time with Terry Gilliam's another one that for a while there, he was making a lot of successful films, you know, 12 Monkeys, The Fisher King, you know, he had some awards nominations.
Well, the studio
was
afraid of him ever since Don Quixote.
Oh, yeah. Boy, even before that, I don't think they kind of like really slowed down once his film started. Like each film got less and less, wasn't making its money back. And like, I know he got to the point where I think he went to like a Comic Con and he had a sign that was like, director will work for food, like kind of joking that like he can't get anyone to finance his films. And at this point, like his last few, like Zero Theorem, are mostly being financed by like obscure German and European companies. They're not anywhere near being financed by like a major studio at this point.
He's got a weird style, but I kind of do respect that. Hey, Coppola, he's made fantastic movies in the 70s. Now he can't make a fucking thing at all. There's something big that he said he wanted to make. I can't remember what it was, like Napoleon or some shit like that.
Yeah.
And it's going to be returned to form. I mean, the last couple movies that you had come out weren't even good. So do you still have it? I don't think you even need to still have it. You can have a couple good movies and that could be your whole run.
Yeah, that run that he had of doing Godfather 1 and 2, The Conversation, Apocalypse Now.
If you just edit it right there, people would be like, he should have went on to do more. He was clearly the best filmmaker of all time. Because then you have movies like Godard, where Godard's still alive making movies. He made a 3D movie like a couple years ago that people were saying was good. But his prime was in the 1960s. Rarely do they talk about any movies after that. And if they do, they're like early 70s. Or like his one from 80-81 that he's done. Then they don't talk about him anymore. He's no Scorsese, I guess.
Yeah, I do think the Coens really enjoy working with these character actors that aren't as concerned with how they're going to be portrayed or their image. You get like a lot of those actors that, especially like the leading men, they don't want to be weak or they don't want to play a character that's has like weird morals or does something strange. Like they want to protect their image that, oh, I can't get cast in other movies because I was in that weird Coen brothers movie where I wrestled John Goodman or something like that. They definitely enjoy working with the guys like Steve Buscemi and John Turturro that they can just kind of like give them a character and say, yeah, this guy is weird. He does strange things. He says very weird things. Yeah, just go with that and kind of just letting them be what they want
to
be.
I would love to learn more about how it actually comes to be. I'd love to be on a Coen set. The little tiny things that they take that are mundane and they make them funny, like the stuff with Pete, the elevator guy. When Barton Fink first walks into the elevator, he's just standing there. It's a little too long and he's like floor 6, and then the guy has like almost no reaction for like a couple more seconds, then he shuts it and he's like 6, and then when the door opens he's like, this is floor 6, but he's already off the elevator. And then later when he's going down the elevator and he asks Pete if he's read the Bible, and Pete's like, the Holy Bible, and he's just sort of like, yeah, and he's like, I think so, or at least I've heard about it before. It's just like such a weird, just a little things like that. Yeah. Like, I don't know where they thought about it. When he rings the bell for Chet the first time, which way is this guy coming? And he comes out of the fucking floor and there's no questions asked about what he was doing.
Yeah, where he was.
Yeah. My name's Chet. And he writes it down. It's Chet. Like, he says it multiple times.
Yeah, on like a note card and just hands it to him.
And then when he's actually picking up the shoes later in the hallway, Barton looks out and he hears the noise and then like kind of goes back into his room so Chet doesn't see him. And it's just like too long of Chet being suspicious about maybe there's somebody else in the hallway with him. They do weird shots like that too, like the moment when they all go to the park to have like that picnic thing and the writer gets drunk and he leaves and the shot's just so long that you think he's gonna get run over by a car or something. It's on him for so long, you're like, something's gonna happen to this guy.
Yeah.
When he's gonna walk home, he can walk it off or whatever, and you're like, no, something bad's gonna happen. And I guess maybe that's what it is, saying it out loud there. It's foreshadowing that something bad's going to happen, but it's not necessarily happening to that character.
Everything in this movie looks good. This is their first one with Roger Deakins.
Yeah, and he hasn't done anything with them for a while, I don't think.
All the other ones, what was the last thing? Maybe True Grit? Did Did he do that one?
True Grit, I think he did do. And then that sure might be his last one. That Villeneuve guy, he's stolen Deakins.
He's taken him. He's got him now. First three films they did with Barry Sonnenfeld, who then went on to direct The Addams Family and Men in Black. There was a funny moment. I was trying to look up because I couldn't remember if he directed all three Men in Black films, which he did.
Oh, that's surprising because they don't seem like they were made by the same person at all.
I know. I at least didn't think he did the third one. Like, I thought he did the first two, but I thought he only, like, maybe produced the third one or something like that. But he directed it. The script for the third one was written by Ethan Coen, E-T-A-N-C-O-H-E-N. And my first thought was, do you think they got him back by being like, hey, Coen's in on this film. He used to work with the Coens, right? We got him writing the script. Like, they pulled a Bill Murray on him with Garfield.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking about. Film. You've managed to bring up Garfield in two movies in a row by connecting it off of something that what's-his-face said.
Yeah, Bill Murray. I'll work him into the next episode, too. We'll get a Garfield reference in every episode this year. That's the goal.
Roderick James is their fake editing name, and it was sad because when I saw Macbeth, it said Reginald James, which I guess just is...
Probably is just Joel.
Yeah.
Like, I want to say that they use that somewhere else. You're reminding me because I haven't seen Macbeth, but I feel like they used that...
The Reginald one before?
That I read it somewhere else. I think that was a name they might have used for, like, one of the Coens, like, writing something else one time, and they used, like, a different version of it or something like that. I'm trying to think of what else I might have seen that, because I thought it was different. Like, it wasn't Roderick, it was the other version that they used.
They're basically Steven Soderbergh if they didn't want to take credit for everything.
Yeah.
Maybe they just had so many problems with the Directors Guild that after that they thought, fuck it, we'll just make up names.
Yeah, they just go off and do whatever they want.
It's kind of sad. Like, I mean, we're obviously getting to a point where all these filmmakers that we love, they're getting up there in age. I mean, we do have a new generation that's coming through, and a lot of them show potential. Villeneuve, Aronofsky, and Ari Aster. Like, I think these are a whole bunch of good filmmakers that are out there, and I'm sure there'll be a lot more. Eggers.
Yeah, David Eggers.
That Michael Bay, he's still out there making movies.
Still out there crushing it.
Because we talked about it. Scorsese, he's up there. Obviously, Clint Eastwood's up there. Spielberg's in his 70s, too. You never know how long that these people are going to last, especially when just revisiting all the Scream movies. We lost Wes Craven so early in life. We got Carpenter. He's pretty much done, too.
Carpenter's like the version that's just like, nah, I'm just going to make music with my kid now.
The weird thing about it is, though, I can see people being upset, but at the same time, at least you're not being let down by, like, The Ward or something.
Carpenter? Yeah, The Ward. That one's...
I mean, it doesn't seem like his work, but I mean, also, if you watch, I don't mean to be mean, but you watch his later movies, they're not nearly as good. I wonder how it even worked out. When you get to the Halloween movies where people are playing homage to his work and he's pretty much just getting to do the music, yeah, it comes off so much better. I would probably want to go that route too. Filmmaking is a tough business to be in, so I can understand the idea of not being in it. But I also do like think of when you get these big prolific directors like Scorsese, where he's like, I got 10 projects. And I'm thinking, how are you going to do 10 more projects?
He finds a way.
He like makes movies with his kid, TikTok videos and shit like that. So the Coens, I think, are particular tastes. And I feel like as we go through these movies, we're discovering that they're genre bending, essentially. And they don't have that auteur style, really. Because all these jokes that are in this movie, like Barton Fink, you can trace them back to some of the older stuff. You can trace a lot of it to Hudsucker Proxy and Raising Arizona. But then when you get to something like Fargo, it's fucking gone. I mean, you get some comedy in that, but...
Yeah, it's there.
It seeps away, you know?
They do like to go back and forth. Yeah, I don't know that any of their movies are completely devoid of comedy, other than, again, here and there when you get the... Fargo is a little bit deeper, or No Country for Old Men is definitely one of their most. That one's pretty straightforward as being like just a very violent, dark film. There's not a whole lot of comedy to be found in that movie. But the way that they go back and forth, like going from something like Blood Simple, and then I love that was apparently their whole plan for Raising Arizona was they just wanted to make a movie that was as completely opposite from Blood Simple as they could get. And I feel like Raising Arizona is 100% about as completely opposite from Blood Simple as you could be.
I love that moment, too, where they're escaping from prison and John Goodman is ripping him out from like his foot from in the mud.
Yeah. Yeah, they actually, I mean, they did that version before Shawshank Redemption, and it's essentially the same exact shot, and that turns out to be the whole joke when Holly Hunter asks, like, what's that smell? And he's like, oh, well, ma'am, when we were liberating ourselves from captivity, we happened to hit the main sewer line, so... The
book probably existed by then. I don't know.
Yeah, it probably was around the same time. I think it was probably in the mid-80s that book came out. That was 87, I think, for Raising Arizona, so they probably came out around the same time, but something about all of their films, especially at least like coming up with these early ones, it keeps recurring of characters having dreams and talking about how their dreams are happening. Nicolas Cage talks about, he has that dream about the demon biker showing up. He has that foreshadowing, and then that's how the film closes out, where he talks about his dream where he watches his kids play football and grow up and be great, and he actually has a family later on. And then also randomly in his dream, he's like, and I'd like to imagine the brothers put themselves back in prison because they realized they just weren't ready for the outside world. And like, we see John Goodman like lowering him back into the hole to go back into prison.
Well, he has like the dreams, and then this is nightmares.
That's what this ends up coming to. Gabriel Byrne has like his dream about his hat blowing on the wind, which is one of my favorite lines in that film, when Marcia Gay Harden's like, and let me guess, you ran after the hat. And he's like, no, I let it blow away. There's nothing more ridiculous than a man chasing his hat in the wind. this definitely feels like, it definitely feels like a waking nightmare, and it slowly gets more and more absurd. It's very much like Franz Kafka. Any of his stories where the characters just start to lose their complete sense of reality and everything feels like a made up world, especially in the end when he goes back to the producer's office and he's in that ridiculous outfit. Oh, I'm sorry, mister. And he's like, it's Colonel now. And he's like just yelling at him.
Not Colonel yet. This is just from the wardrobe department.
Yeah. He's like, it's not official, but I had props whip me up something real quick. And then, when we finally get, the finale, especially when John Goodman gives him that box, that once we learn some facts about his character, that box is very head-sized.
You gotta go back just a tad bit. You gotta go back to the moment that he hooks up with that woman.
Oh yeah, the writer's wife that is revealed that she's been writing all of his stories.
Mind you, this is also, this won like a bunch of awards at the Cannes Festival, and Roman Polanski was the president or the juror, like the main juror for that, because it seems like it's something kind of like Repulsion or Rosemary's Baby or The Tenant. Like, it has that like weird psychological horror element to it, and the movie's kind of been funny up until this moment where he wakes from his, you think it's gonna be a dream or a nightmare. He went to bed with that woman. It has the mosquito biting her, and he slaps the mosquito. It's like too much blood. But then blood starts like seeping from underneath of her, and he has that loud scream that is almost like Marv from Home Alone, because we'll bring it up again.
And again, we get that same exact shot of the wall, and you just know John Goodman's jumping out of bed, and it tracks him as he's clearly running into the hallway to come next door to John Turturro's room.
Yeah, and John Turturro like sends him away, like, oh no, it's nothing, it's nothing. And then he realizes that he needs help and he needs to call the police, and he goes back over to John Goodman's apartment, but John Goodman won't let him in, which I think is a nice little
I gotta go into your apartment. He's like, no, it's better at yours.
Yeah, let's go to yours. This is like another red flag for this character that John Goodman plays. He's disturbed by what he sees,
but he's a little too comfortable with like he already has a plan.
Don't worry, man, I'll take care of this. And has this great dark humor in it too, where John Turturro is like having a fucking panic attack, and he's in the bathroom and he's just like shaking in the corner and he's just watching, and John Goodman walks by with the body and like fucking hits the head off the dresser or the wall or whatever.
Smacks the head on the
But then then it's like he's like, no, you don't want to turn this into the police. I'll take care of this, buddy.
Yeah, they hang people for this.
And then he says that after they do the cleanup, just don't tell anybody about this. And I'm a resident here, but I'm going to be gone for a couple of days. I'm going to be going to New York. Yeah. And he's like, oh, yeah, you should
stop in and see my parents.
See my parents and my uncle while you're.
I also love he doesn't like John Turturro never gets rid of that mattress that's covered in blood. Like, he never does anything with it. So it's always just there in his room. When John Goodman goes to leave for his trip and he gives him that box that at first, again, you don't have the information yet, but it's just like it already seems like there's like going to be a head or something in the box. It's so weird because he's like, it's all my earthly possessions in one box, and he just gives it to him and tells him to hold on to it, which it's
definitely a head inside that box, but there are so many characters whose head
it could be. But and then we get introduced to those the two cops who are very funny and like just always like mocking Bart and Fink the whole time. Like when he's like, did he tell you any other information? And he's like,
he said he liked Jack Oakey pictures.
You know, ordinarily we say anything you might remember could be helpful. But I'll be frank with you, Fink. That is not helpful.
Notice how he's not writing it down.
Yeah, I do love
that. I also love that little moment, too, where he hands him his card, but drops it.
Yeah. Yeah, they're mocking him. But...
Well, they also do. They do the reveal that John Goodman is, like, wanted for being a serial
madman
killer.
Yeah, and that's when we find out that information. But you know, Bart and Fink suddenly gets inspired. He sits that box next to his typewriter and he finishes cranks out the whole screenplay overnight. To which the producer hates it and thinks it's the worst thing ever because it's too it seems like it's too artsy for him. He just wanted
it doesn't have enough action with the wrestling.
He's like, come on, man, it's two wrestlers wrestling in the ring. I don't need someone wrestling with their soul. We don't need that kind of crap here. But yeah, when he shows back up at his apartment and they're reading the script.
Yeah, it's a little homophobic because he keeps throwing out like the, I don't want that fruity stuff. Yeah. And then the detectives are very anti-Semitic. Like they're like, you're Jewish. Like it's a big, like they're just disgusted with him by that fact alone.
Yeah. When they get to that finale, which again, yeah, I knew that was how the movie was going to end even since it was spoiled for me. But that is such a great moment when they, you know, they reveal that not only was that woman dead, but now her husband's also dead and he's missing his head too. Like they're like, oh, what are you in on it with?
And he can't get a hold of his family.
Oh yeah. When he keeps
that,
calling.
That John Goodman reached out. Yeah.
He keeps calling.
Says he visited.
He can't get a hold of anybody. So it 100% seems like he probably murdered his family too.
So there's like five possible heads that we know of that could possibly be in that box. Yeah.
That's when it truly does turn into like 100% like some hallucinatory dream when the whole building just like catches on fire seemingly out of nowhere. Like John Goodman is just Satan himself walking out of the elevator and the whole hotel just starts smoking and the two detectives just start going, why is it so hot in here? They just keep sweating and it's like, and then just
it is hot. The whole movie is about how hot, miserably hot that place is. After they handcuff him to the bed and they go out into the hallway, you could see that it is at literally smoking and there's fire coming out from like the floor underneath.
Yeah.
So that, yeah, it's a great moment where it's like, it has that Western vibe
that,
to
yeah,
it.
Yeah, that set design in that hallway, which yeah, that's their Kubrickian hallways that seem to go on forever. But the way they built that set to just have the flames just shooting out from him as he's charging down the hallway with his shotgun just looks so great. I know I read that they were originally going to do that with like digital effects, but then they decided to just do it practically and actual, just have like just gas jets shooting flames out. And I don't think it would work as well if it was CGI. Like there is something about having just actual, just flaming hallway, just him charging down there.
I watched this interview with John Turturro and he said that when he left, he's like, oh yeah, it was all real fire and stuff. So they gave me flame retardant clothes and they put stuff in my hair so it wouldn't catch on fire. They made me walk down this set with fire all over the place. And they basically said like, oh, if you catch on fire, just drop to the ground, then we'll fire extinguisher you. And he's like, I'm really afraid like the entire time that I'm leaving that I'm just going to burst into flames from some of the fire that I'm walking by. He's like, it was real fucking hot and everything. How safe are those effects? They were not very safe. They made it sound like I could accidentally catch on fire at any moment. Yeah. But yeah, that scene is great where it is have like this old West vibe to it where he's like, this tension builds and this character, when the character shows up and you're sort of like, what is he? And he pulls out that shotgun and starts charging them down the hallway. And you know that he took care of that body. So you know that he is very much this serial killer character.
Yeah.
But after he takes care of both the cops in the most violent way, I love that shot from John Turturro's perspective, Barton Fink, where he's handcuffed to the bed and the hallway is just flames. Hallway. And then John Goodman's character walks by just very casually, like a shotgun. And then he comes back and it's just like,
there's a great reaction when Turturro says, they called you Madman Munt. If it isn't my physical appearance, it's my mental state. Like, he's just like, why is everyone always getting down on me?
He's like, I've never been mad in my life. I'm not mad. What I would define as the prime Coen experience is something like this surreal scene that you brought up where the whole hotel is on fire burning. After the police are murdered, the detectives or whatever, and John Goodman comes in, the tension is with him, and there's no tension whatsoever with the blazing fire all around them. Yeah. They sit down and have a casual conversation, essentially. Goodman ends up saving him like he's the strong man from the circus where he busts the old school bed to get him out of there. But even that, like, after they're done, he's going back into his, like, flaming apartment, and John Turturro's, like, just getting his valuables and casually leaving the hotel.
He grabs the box and the script.
Yeah.
To which John Goodman tells him, oh, by the way, I lied. That's not my box.
And then that picture, that shitty picture that he keeps looking at in his hotel room, which you think is going to give him, like, inspiration. And I don't even know what the meaning of it would be. Thought that it was, like, cheap escapism or something. But then when they basically recreate the shot at the end with the woman on the beach when he finally goes to the beach, I don't even know how to feel about it. But I do like when she's questions, what's in the box? And he's like, I don't know. So there you go. Like,
is it yours?
This movie did Shawshank first. It did Seven first.
It beat everybody to the punch.
It beat all the big 90s movies.
Yeah, it's some sort of like inspiration for him. Like he does stare at it. And I think it is. I don't know what it's necessarily supposed to like mean at the end. I just took it as he looks at it as being different from his surroundings. Like it's a nice, like beautiful place. Whereas he's sitting in this dump of a hotel where everything's peeling off the walls and, you know, everything looks like garbage and the place is falling apart around him. And he just keeps looking at this picture. Yeah. Some sort of like fantasy that he's imagining of him just going to the beach and like having a good day. But it's like something that he just feels like he can't actually experience because he's too paranoid. He's too obsessed with everything. Like he can't just have like a carefree day at the beach. It's just not in his personality.
But the thing that helped him get through his writer's block was essentially a murder or like a very violent cover up of, I mean, we don't necessarily know what killed that woman. I mean, he was asleep. It could have been John Goodman for all we know.
I mean, yeah, I think the implication is that it's John Goodman, which yeah, it's something in that final exchange that they have when, that keeps going back to what like Steve Buscemi asks him when he first gets there. He's like, trans or res? And then like he doesn't understand what he means, and he's like, are you a transient or a resident? And he's like, oh, I'll be here indefinitely. And he's like, oh, that means resident. And he even tells him like, you're just a tourist with a typewriter, whereas I live in hell, which is like what John Goodman tells him.
You come to my house and you tell me how to act.
Tell me I'm loud. Yeah. There's a great moment there where, that's like, I guess, where it feels like, you know, it's like trying to teach him a lesson about like that you either need to, you can't just like pretend that you're, you know, like a real common man while at the same time you're going to like spout off these big tales. And even when John Goodman tells him, like, you just don't listen, Barton, like he just screams that at him. Like, because we know he's just been cutting him off all the time.
Right.
Every time he tries to tell a story, he always cuts him off and he never listens to anybody. Just a fun movie. Well, you know, and then starts to become less fun.
Well, it's like defined as like this character that just takes. He just takes, takes, takes. He never gives anything. And he's disillusioned, too, to the idea of like what a common man even is. Like that moment when he's calling him a common man over and over again, it's so insulting. It's like the common man, like you.
The furthest he can get with what a common man is he must live in a tenement building in the city. And like, that's as far as he can get. Like, even with his script, that's what he starts off with. Like, fade in, a tenement building. We hear the cry of the fishmonger, which is straight up from his play. Because when we see the play at the very beginning, there's like the character that comes off screen and is like, fish here, we got fish. And I'm like, is that just what he thinks? Like, the common man is like, you know, he lives down the street from the fishmonger in a tenement building. Like, that's all he can come up with. He can't actually.
I like when he reads the Bible and he thinks that he's plagiarizing the Bible.
Yeah, Genesis is like fade into a tenement building. We hear the fishmonger, and then like beneath it just says like, and God said let there be light. Like it just continues like that. Yeah, I did enjoy that. That's another one of those like really surreal moments when he's just like completely hallucinating and like losing his mind.
Well, it seems like you enjoyed the movie.
I did.
It's very rare of a Coen Brothers film that I don't like, and I think the style is just so different from film to film. Whatever this movie is saying, the things that I pick up from it are basically write what you know, and this is how Hollywood will really treat you. I mean, all the stuff that he feared from Hollywood was true. Because, like, another disheartening moment, too, it's not as powerful as you might have murdered somebody and disposed of the body. But when the producer says, we own all the ideas in your head, and that horror for a writer of saying, we own you, and we're never going to publish any of your stuff. No one will ever know who you are. And I'm like, oh, my God, that literally be the worst thing ever. Did something similar like that happen with Kesha, with her music?
Like, yeah, she couldn't produce any music because, yeah, her contract with the record company, she couldn't release any albums without them being, like, produced by that guy Dr. Luke, who's, like, the person that she made all the accusations against. And is like, yeah, that's the guy that, like, assaulted me. And they're like, well, if you want to make another album, you got to work with him. And she's like, I don't think I'm going to do that.
Hopes and dreams crumbling around you. The wallpaper falling off the walls. I do like when the wallpaper falls off real hard and John Goodman says, you've kind of suspected that it's not, it's the whole hotel, not just this room. But he's like, oh, your place does that too.
Yeah.
I think it was a good representation of what's going on inside of Barton Fink's head. The hair gets bigger. So it's like his head gets bigger as the movie goes along too. Actually gets bigger. And John Turturro is such a great actor.
They're all good in this one.
They are. And we're going to move into comedy next week.
Another film starring Steve Buscemi, John Turturro, and John Goodman.
Yeah, it's got all the familiar faces in it. Yeah, I didn't even think about that. It does. It has like all the big characters follow into the next one and then don't really follow into the other two.
Cool, but a character from the next one comes up in another one. There's always a connection.
The Coen brothers connection.
They're similar, I guess, like Wes Anderson. Like once they work with an actor, as long as you can like get with their style, like they'll just keep bringing you back for whatever and they'll start like writing parts specifically just for you.
Well, we'll see how their career even ends up going, because French Dispatch I just watched, and since it's like three stories in one, there are so many cameos and people that I don't think have ever been in their stuff before. So they're really filling up the Wes Anderson slate of actors.
Yeah. Wes Anderson stepping in on Joel Coen's territory. He's got Francis McDormand coming back for, you know, popping up in some roles.
That might be the biggest one. Stealing Joel Coen's wife.
Yeah, now she hangs out with Wes Anderson doing goofy movies and, you know, hanging out with Timothée Chalamet.
She does more than hang out with him.
That's going to be your next thing is like, Joel, whatever your next movie is, you got to put Timmy in it.
Honestly, I watched like three movies in a row that had him in it, I think. He was in The French Dispatch, and then he was in Don't Look Up.
He's in Dune.
Obviously Dune, but I swear there was something else that I watched last minute and he was like fucking in that too. I'm like, how did he get picked up for like literally everything?
I don't know why. I still love the that one tweet, like, I'm gonna give Dune an 8 out of 10 because I refuse to give that film any film starring and like whatever they made fun of, like mocked his name. Like what I can't think of what they said, but like any film with Timothée Chalamet is never gonna get a 10 out of 10 from me.
Maybe we'll have to cover him 1 month to be like, what's the Timothée Chalamet appeal?
Yeah, where does it come from?
I don't know. Well, you talked about it a little bit earlier while you talked about Pete Davidson, and people were like, I don't get the appeal to him. And I'm like, I get the appeal to him, though. He's like, he's funny. He comes off genuine. That makes sense to me. Remember those weird pictures from a couple years ago where he was with Johnny Depp's daughter, I think, and they're like kissing on a yacht, and they're making fun of how awkward he was?
I don't remember that.
No, you gotta look it up. It was just people just attacking him left and right for like how uncomfortable he looked in that moment from whatever the paparazzi took their pictures of. That ends our first episode of the year for Cinema Demore. We're at Cinema Demore on Twitter. I'm at JJMorgan19 on Twitter. Chuck's taking a big yawn.
Yeah, just like my Twitter, ChuckFinn66. Just a big yawn.
/ Cinema Demore on Facebook. That's where you can see all our great ads and know what we're doing next. Please subscribe, rate, and review. Chuck, when you have a minute, maybe after you watch the new West Side Story, listen to that episode. The Three Deemers made commercials for our podcast on their podcast. Lexi was like, I hope that's all right. I'm like, I like them. I wouldn't be like offended. We got ads out there now. Nice. Maybe we'll make one for them. We'll see if they like it. It'll be ridiculous. But until then, see you next week.
Thanks.
Thank you.
We are Cinema D'Amore. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter to stay up to date with news and information on upcoming episodes. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Podbean, Spotify, Amazon Music, Audible, Pandora, Alexa, or iHeartRadio. It would be greatly appreciated if you subscribe to our podcast on your platform of choice. We also appreciate feedback, so rate us, review us, and let us know what you think. And above all else, thank you for listening.